You're listening to Leading with Empathy and Allyship, where we have deep, real conversations to build empathy for one another and to take action to become more inclusive leaders in our workplaces and communities. I'm Melinda Brianna Epler, founder and CEO of Change Catalyst. I'm a diversity, equity, and inclusion speaker, writer, and advisor. You can learn more about my work and sign up to join us for a live recording at changecatalyst.co/allyship series. All right, let's dive in. So today we are here with Manisha Amin, who has been a friend and an ally. We have fascinating conversations about diversity, equity, and inclusion across the borders. So welcome, Manisha.
Hello, Melinda. It's so nice to be here today.
And today we're going to talk about getting over our fear as allies. We're going to talk about what to do when we make mistakes, how ways to avoid making mistakes in the first place, and how to call people in, how to forgive, how to educate when people make mistakes too.
Absolutely. And I think coming from lovely Australia, there's something that we always do when we start our conversations, and that is really to acknowledge the land that we're on here today. So if you don't mind, Melinda, I am really fortunate to live in an incredible city called Sydney, which is actually on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation here in Australia. And I'd really like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land because, you know, for those of you who might not know, Sydney was never seceded and this land is and always will be Aboriginal. And I'd also just like to acknowledge any First Nations people who are on this call today.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I will also do the same. And you know, I'm here in San Francisco. Well, my team is here as well. We are on the traditional land of the Rematush Ohlone people in Yalamu. Unfortunately, there are no people left from Yalamu. However, their ancestors from the Ohlone people that are still here and present. And I honor their elders, past, present, and future, and emerging, and recognize that and appreciate anyone who is on the call and listening on the podcast as well, who is Native. And also recognize that Native people are continuing to experience a lot of really difficult times right now with COVID and increasing experiences around COVID and the continuous perpetuation of what happened in colonization is now affecting health and lives today too. So, well, let's jump in. And that was kind of an impromptu thing. Neither one of us told each other that we were going to do that. So we can, if anybody is interested, share links in the follow-up to our episode if you want to also recognize an Indigenous people in your meetings and in what you do. So we'll share that in the resources following the episode. So let's talk about you. And I know what you're going to say, but
can you tell?
So what we want to know is who are you and where did how did you come to do the work that you do? Go for it.
Look, and it's an interesting question, especially for me, because normally that comes with who are you and where did you come from, right? And so I was actually born in Africa, in Kenya, and moved to Australia when I was 5. It was in the 1970s. So actually the White Australia policy had just finished in Australia when we came over. So when I went to school, I was one of only 3 people of colour in my school. The other was my sister, an Aboriginal boy, Charlie Longfellow. And I remember his name specifically because he was the only other person who was brown-skinned at the time. And I think that really, I was only 5, but I'd come from living in with my extended family in a country that looked very, very different. My sister was 4. It didn't impact her the way it impacted me. But from that time, I think I've always been interested in difference and what that means and how that works. So I've had a range of different jobs in a range of different places. But what I do try to do is look for jobs that make it worthwhile to get up in the morning every day. And I now obviously work for a place called the Centre for Inclusive Design. And we started the centre about 4 years ago, but it came from an organisation that had been around for a really long time, actually. We started as the Australian Captioning Centre. We brought captions to Australia at a time when there weren't any captions. And I love telling this story because at the time, captions were for people who were deaf. And now when we think about captions, I think most of us use or experience captions at different times. So whether it's, you know, pre-COVID when you're getting your nails done, or we're sitting in a pub and the screen, or at a gym and there's captions on the television, to actually watching a television show next to someone who doesn't want to hear the sound. You know, we're all doing that now. And it just shows how, what the power of inclusion in inclusive design can be.
So I want to talk about, you know, when I do work helping people become better allies, better advocates, the biggest piece often of the kind of growth and behavior change is getting over the fear. Yeah. So let's talk about fear a bit, fear of failure, fear of making mistakes, and where it comes from.
Look, I think it's a really interesting topic. I'm so glad we get to speak about this today, right?
Yeah.
Because it often, when we speak, it's about the topic, it's about allyship in the sense of the content. But I think one of the hardest things, the hardest thing I found, is actually this idea of fear and perfection. And I think it's interesting reflecting on my story, because when I think about my story, and we're all different, right? But I think that being someone who was different made me hypervigilant in some ways and made me want to be perfect, because I had to be a particular way in order to not stand out. And many of us have this because of all sorts of things. It could be because of our gender, our race. It could be because of difficulties we have had. It could be just because of what we've been told as children. But when we want to fit in, and it's a human nature thing to fit in, it becomes quite awkward when we're doing something that's a little bit different that makes us stand out. And then on top of that, at the moment, I think, especially when it comes to allyship, when we're talking with people, who, what can we talk about? What can't we talk about? You know, when are we with people, but when are we actually being a bit patronizing? And what happens when we get it wrong? Because I'm not too sure about yourself, Melinda, but I get it wrong all the time.
Yes.
All the time.
And yeah, it's just kind of a part of what it means to be a good human, to be a good ally, and to do your best to
exactly.
Change.
And yeah. We're all learning, right? And things happen around us, and we kind of go, oh, if that happens, am I allowed to talk up? Am I mm-hmm. still allowed to have this conversation? And The thing I've been thinking about this week is righteous anger as well. You know, am I allowed to be righteous in my anger if I believe strongly in something? Or, and you know, and even if I'm not allowed, but is it okay to have righteous anger? What does that mean? What's the impact of that? And how does that come back to me? How does it bounce back?
Yeah, absolutely. So where do your fears come from? Do you have fears of making mistakes? Where do they come from?
And when you say, where do they come from? What do you mean?
What are they? What are your fears? What are your fears? Maybe start there and then maybe where they come from.
Perfect. Well, you know, I actually, look, I worry about talking about, as a person of color, I came to Australia when I was 5. As you can hear, I have a very strong accent, which is very Australian, but my husband is not Indian. I don't cook Indian food at home. And therefore, I sometimes go, well, am I really, there's a term we use called a coconut. So a coconut is brown on the outside and white on the inside. And so sometimes I go, am I Indian enough? You know, when I'm in India, I never feel like I'm not Indian enough, except when I'm with my partner. And then I feel like maybe I'm not Indian enough because the way people treat me changes. My favorite is, I learnt my politics in the 80s in the UK. And at the time, we had a movement which was, we called ourselves Black. So it was Asian people and people who were African or Afro-Caribbean. And it was part of a discourse around colonization. And it was Black in a political sense. And that's what I've aligned with. But the world has changed, right? So that term is no longer a term that relates to somebody with my experiences and my background. And I've had to unlearn and relearn that. I struggle with things like them and they, because it's just not part of the way that I've been taught. So in the last week, it's been hilarious. I have tried really hard to actually get rid of pronouns from all my conversation, just to see if I can make them really hyper-visible, because I realize that actually I don't need to know whether it's her car or his car. I just need to know it's a car. So I've been really playing with how that lands and what that means. And so I think in all the work we do, there's always something that comes up where someone will say, or put their hand up and say, actually, Manisha, not too happy with what you've just said. And as someone who can't spell, so probably dyslexic, very highly likely dyslexic, I remember being in a workshop once and I had a migraine. And so my assist swapped roles with me. So she actually took over some of the presentation, which was a great experience for her. However, we forgot that there was a reason that I didn't take assist roles, and that is because I can't spell. And within 10 minutes of being on in this workshop, someone called out and said, I think it's not okay if you can't spell accessibility in an accessibility workshop. And I remember looking at this word and I knew it was wrong. And I was just looking at it and there was no way I could make it right because I couldn't remember what the letters looked like. And I just had to say, look, I'm really sorry. I can't. And that also becomes hard, right? Because I didn't want to shame the other person. You know, I didn't want to sort of, because we were an inclusive workshop, I didn't want to say, well, you know, it's your bad now, because really it's because I'm dyslexic and I struggle to spell. But I did want to talk about that idea if I have to justify this really did arise. So it's really tricky to know what to say, when to justify, when not to justify. And so now what I do is I try really hard to get out of my head and just do what arises.
Interesting.
And sometimes that works. Sometimes it really doesn't. It's my way of going, actually, I need to just do what comes at that moment and trust that what I do will come from the right place then.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a piece of accessibility around, you know, dyslexia too, right?
And, yes,
and acknowledging
exactly.
That and, you know, yeah. Well, so when you make mistakes, what do you do? And maybe I can also say, I've also made a ton of mistakes, and that is a part of learning. That is a part of unlearning, because there, you know, a lot of this is what we learned because we have popular culture that has racism, that has sexism and ableism and ageism and all the isms, as my friend Rachel Williams would say. And, you know, we learn them from each other. We learn them from our parents. We learn them from TV and popular culture, entertainment, advertisements, all of those things. And it's really on us all to unlearn. And also language is always changing. Identity politics are always changing as well. Identity politics is right, maybe, but just identity language and understanding is always changing as well. So, you know, one big mistake we made was at our very first Tech Inclusion Conference. We wanted to be very inclusive, but we just didn't think about people with disabilities. It just wasn't on our radar. And it took two individuals, one who is blind, one is deaf, to advocate for themselves, like adamantly advocate for themselves to make sure that they had what they needed to feel included at our event. And I learned a ton from that, you know, and as a result, actually, in addition to understanding what they needed, we made it a more broadly inclusive event as well for other people with disabilities and people with other disabilities. And then we also addressed it with an ability and tech summit, really, because we realized we weren't alone, that diversity and equity inclusion is so often lacks inclusion for people with disabilities. So we created an event to really address it, and now kind of do it throughout. But it really took us like learning, unfortunately, that is often the issue here is that it's the labor of people who are suffering from and experiencing exclusion that wake us up.
And I think as you were speaking, I think what comes up for me as well is, as someone who wants to do good, and often allies, I think, have high empathy. You know, we tend to really care about the people we work with. When we get called out, when I get called out, I feel shame, you know, that I've done the wrong thing and that I'm a terrible person. So that idea of compassion becomes really, really important, and self-compassion and kindness. But I think it also reminds me of, whether we have empathy or not, when someone calls us out, how we feel. So whether that person is being inclusive or not, when we're called out, we feel awful. We feel shame. And that shame can go two ways, right? We can learn from it, or we can stand our ground and try to deflect it and reject it. And that second part does not lead to change. So it's the gift you just, it's the gift I know I need, but I don't necessarily want. So
It's not necessarily an easy gift to take.
No. Either, right? Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, but an important one. And it gets easier. That's the thing too, is, you know, I mean, now as a result of that particular point in time, now here we are, and we have helped push the tech industry and pushed events to be more inclusive for people with disabilities. And, you know, it has given us the opportunity to, in so many ways, create change.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, Melinda, I was talking to someone about this workshop yesterday, and what they said really resonates with what you're talking about, because what they were talking about was, you know, we get it wrong a lot. And this was a university talking. They said, we get it wrong a lot, but when we get it right, it's transformative. And I think the work you do, when you get it right, those workshops you've run because of that conversation, you know, having been in some of your conferences, the way people with disability are included, because you've got it right, it's transformative. So it's really lovely that, you know, even if we do get it wrong, the right matters.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. What are some of the things that you go through in your head after you make a mistake and somebody has pointed it out?
So you're talking to someone who ruminates. And Melinda, this week, I've had one of those weeks. It's been a week where I've had challenges from a personal and kind of family perspective. And so in my head, I get the, you're a bad person, you could have done better, what if this? And then that future casting, don't we love that? Because you've done this, this is going to happen. All of that goes on in my head all the time. And what I've really been thinking about is that there's two parts to my brain, one part that's doing the thinking and one part that's watching that thinking and commenting on it. And boy, does it love to comment. So the thing that works for me, I think we're all different. My partner is great. He looks at me and he says, what do you mean you talk to yourself in your head? Because he doesn't understand that. It doesn't happen for him. So what I tend to do is try to get back in my body. So if I can feel my body and feel my senses and trust myself, then that works. And that's where I think Crystal's just said kindness and love. So for me, kindness and love are felt things, emotional things, rather than the things that sit in my head. So if I breathe and trust in myself and my faith, whatever that faith is, and trust in my surroundings and really just sort of say, well, you know, huh, that's interesting, and stop there. We've had some real issues this last week in Australia in terms of our parliament, and women have arisen everywhere to sort of say enough is enough. And so one part of me has gone on the march and really been able to show my solidarity. The other part has sort of sat back and said, well, what can I do productively to bring change so that this isn't just emotion that sits in me? And how can I bring change with compassion? And so I wrote an article. I sent it to my sister, who said, who's fantastic, who said, there's nothing you're saying here that hasn't been said before. And it's too emotional. I said, great. She said, did you just write this for yourself? I said, yeah, probably. But then I took it back home and I gave it to some of our young female staff and trans staff who said, no, actually, we've not heard this before. And then we looked at the article and said, well, what do we want to do as an organisation? So what we've actually constructed is a program that talks about how we do constructive dialogue and how we can do that in the face of gender inequity and how we can change systems with men and women rather than just looking at the anger that I felt on that first day when I heard about someone who yet again couldn't walk down the street. And so for me, the healthy outcome is how to transform that energy into something more useful. And in the moment, how to actually just not treat myself the way I would hate to treat somebody else.
Yeah. What about when you make a mistake that might cause harm to someone else? You know, what do you do at that point?
Well, see, I think whenever I make a mistake, I'm going to cause someone harm. This is my own mind read. So when I say something and someone says, oh, no, that's not true, my first thought is, oh, I've done something terrible. So I'll often go to that extension, and I'm being very open about this because I think that sometimes we don't have these conversations, right? So I've forgotten actually what your question was. Your question, what do I do? I apologize. And I actually just say, look, I'm really sorry. It depends on what it is. So I might say what I've said might be taken in a particular way. This is how I've meant that. Is that what you read from it? Or is if I see a look or I get a sense that the energy has changed, I'll call that and say, look, I'm feeling that something's changed in the room. Can somebody tell me what that's about?
Yeah.
And we have a really lovely phrase. We talk about wabi-sabi in our work. I'm not too sure how many people have heard the term. It's a Japanese term, but I think it's kintsugi, the work where you have bowls and they've put gold where the fault line is. Or in, you know, this idea of you look at the where something's broken or damaged and we don't fix it so it's invisible so that the damage is not seen, but we highlight the damage. So this is this idea of wabi-sabi is actually the idea of recognizing and validating the failures, the impermanence, the broken. So when we do workshops, we focus on wabi-sabi. Our workshops are imperfect. We're going to get it wrong. And in fact, when we get it wrong, we talk about barnacles. So barnacle moments are light bulb moments, but there are also times when people think what I'm saying is completely incorrect or inappropriate. So energy arises either side, and we want to hear that. Because when we frame it that way, when I frame it that way, it stops being about me and it becomes in service of the group. And so that really helps us to talk about them. And we'll say, has anyone got a barnacle? And really sometimes, especially in Australia, different cultures are different, but we tend to be very polite. So we're nice to the point of bias, really. And so, and the dominant conversation. So if the dominant conversation can be positive, it can also be negative, but people will keep quiet around that dominant conversation. So a lot of what we'll do then is see if we can break that up. And sometimes I'll do it. I'll actually say things that I know, just the way I'm thinking and feeling, and my team will call me out in the middle of the workshop in a way that's actually very open and genuine and loving. And we do that on purpose because I have the most power in the room. So if they can do that, then other people can do that as well in a way. And when I use the word call out here, it's not calling me out. The way they'll do it is go, actually, Manisha, I've got a different perspective on that. Or when you say that, this is what comes up for me. So we're sort of trying to practice what we preach as we go.
So part of that is creating a culture on your team where you're really able to do that for each other, with each other. And then I think the other piece of that is each of us opening up to that feedback. I think that is a really important thing. We don't talk about how to do that. How do we let people know that we're open to feedback? How do we open ourselves up to that feedback?
Yes. And, you know, sometimes we are open and sometimes we're not, right? You know, so there are days when I'm awesome at this and I'm great at taking feedback and it's like, bring it all on. And other days I'm a little bit fragile, or someone can say something and it just triggers something inside me. And I think the thing I'm really learning is that that's okay. It's okay to be fragile and it's okay to say so. So now sometimes I just say that. I'm trying really hard to be as transparent as I can possibly be, just like you were today. In terms of the way you were feeling, I think that we've been brought up, all of us, to be perfect. Zoom and COVID has taught us so much, right? In the past, if we turned up to a meeting 3 minutes late, well, that was not because we didn't understand time, or that it was because we were unprofessional. Whereas now with Zoom, we're all used to sometimes having problems getting from one place to another place. Or if we were having this conversation, you know, a year or two years ago, we'd be hypervigilant about the types of backgrounds we have and where our logos were and all of those things, whereas now we're not. So I think the beauty of that transparency is, how do we bring this into our lives and really be hyperhuman mm-hmm. in our interactions, because when we're human, it's harder for all that judgment and that shame to kind of step in.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, we can't be perfect.
Yeah. So I want to talk about something that has come up in several different episodes, but we haven't really directly addressed it, which I think has a lot to do with fear, is cancel culture and call out culture. And let me just stay a moment for anybody to just kind of ground ourselves in what it means to me. Cancel culture is a public backlash. Usually it can be boycott, some kind of withdrawal of support, some kind of ostracization, an embarrassment around something that somebody does that's offensive, that might be abusive or ignorant, racist, sexist, ableist, heterosexist, all of the isms, again, anti-Muslim, anti-Semitic, anti-trans, et cetera. And while cancel culture is kind of a relatively new term, and for anybody who's interested, a lot of people say that it originated in 1991 in the film New Jack City, but then it didn't really become popular until Black Twitter kind of took it and moved it into popular culture. But it's similar to call-out culture. And call-out culture has been something that has been around since the civil rights movement. It's been around quite a bit longer. So just kind of grounding us all in kind of what we're talking about here. But I do think that, you know, the fear of being called out is real. I don't know if you had some thoughts about that.
You're absolutely right. It is real, you know, and I think if we accept we can't all be perfect, I think cancel culture fits into this notion that we have to be perfect. We have to be right all the time. And the right comes from whoever's got that righteous anger. So, and I think the biggest trouble I see, and the thing that troubles me the most, is that when we're righteous in our anger, there's somebody on the other side who then feels shame and anger, who then becomes righteous in their anger. And the more we do that, the more we push each other away from each other. The more we teach each other that we're different, we're not the same. And the more different we are, the less likely we are to come together and to learn. Exactly. And I think that if it wasn't for, you know, what I would call call out culture on the side of, you know, what I would think of as things that are important to me, we wouldn't necessarily have such a rise in the side of people who say things that are not okay for me, because they now feel victimized. They feel wronged, just like I used to feel wrong. So I think as one voice gets louder, the other voice gets diminished. The voice that's diminished then feels it's okay to call out. They get louder, and we have this vicious cycle of blame rather than a cycle of healing and connection.
Yeah.
I was listening to this fabulous podcast. It's called The Hidden Brain, and they were talking recently about the Pride movement. And when he was talking about the Pride movement, one of the things that's really interesting is that this idea that LGBTQ rights will be normalized in America within 9 years. And this is not the case when we think about elder rights. They're talking 150 years. When we're talking about women's rights, we're talking about 100 years. And so it was really lovely conversation about why that might be. And there's a whole lot of reasons. But one thing that really stood out to me when we were thinking about this notion of call-out culture is this idea that there are two things we want when something goes wrong. One is justice and the other is change. Mm-hmm. When we want justice, we often don't feel like we can break bread with the person we want justice from. We want them to be punished. Okay. Yeah. But when we want change, we need to break bread with that person. We need to sit at the table with that person and we need to understand the system. So as allies, I think we have to be very clear about which one of those we want to do. And we need to understand that breaking bread with somebody whose views are diametrically opposed to us is actually really difficult.
Yeah.
And it's not actually always going to work. And we're going to struggle with that. So I sat down last night and went, okay, who wouldn't I break bread with? And there are a lot of people, let me tell you. And I think my fear is actually when I looked at it, it wasn't that I thought they were bad. My fear was that I wouldn't be able to have a dialogue with them, that I wouldn't be able to connect. So I think that it came back on me and I was like, oh, that's interesting. So do I only have conversations with people that I feel that I can have a meaningful conversation with? Is that where I sit?
Well, I would say, you know, for me, I want to be careful about how I say this, but I do think it's important to understand intent. I think it's first and foremost, understand the impact, right? The impact is the key. And to create change, we also have to understand the intent. If the intent was to harm, those folks I don't generally break bread with. If the intent was not to harm, then we can have a conversation about how you harmed and educate and transform, right? For me, that's what I have chosen myself, is the folks that don't intend to create harm, even though they have created harm, I can work with them. I can help them see the harm that they've caused, what it's coming from, and how to fix it as much as you can, and how to create change moving forward, how to change your behavior moving forward. So that's kind of how I think about it.
And it's an interesting one, I think. I was talking to someone about this the other day. So my belief is that everyone is good and everyone is coming from a good place. But my other belief, and these are really only beliefs, right? There's truth and fact, and these sit in that idea of truth. They're my experiences. They're not fact. I don't know what the fact underneath that would be. So my belief is everyone is good. But my belief is also that our mindset and the way we have come into this world, the cultures around us, the systems around us, and our experiences collude in us making the decisions that we make that are either positive or negative in the way we think about things. So if I hold that belief, then it means that I can feel that for anybody. However, I think that the important thing for me, and you said this so beautifully, is the intention of the person who comes into the conversation in that moment. So their intention might be whatever it is, but if they're not, I can't bring them to the table if they don't want to be at the table. All I can do is sit there and be at the table for whoever wants to be there with me. And sometimes that will work and sometimes it won't. And this question about how do we break the cycle of blame when it's met with anger is to actually, I find this, that's a really interesting question. And for me, where I go back to always is the young people in my life who are often very black and white. And, you know, with someone in my life who has a disability as well, anger is part of communication for them. So how would I want to treat my child, or how would I want to treat a young person who shows anger? That's how I want to treat other people who show anger, because actually anger is just emotion. It's an inability to communicate. So in the face of that, even with my young people, all you can do is recognize that they're angry and wait till they're in a place that they want to talk to you. And if they don't, they don't.
Yeah.
But if we meet a toddler's anger with anger, it doesn't solve anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another way I've heard to look at it, another way people might say to look at it is, you know, instead of calling out, is calling people in.
Yes.
And if people are coming in, if they choose to come in, then you can have, you know, you can have a deeper conversation and really help them change. Yes. Yeah.
And this idea of fact and truth, I think, sits in here as well for me. So I think it's okay to say the system is broken. You know, women are dying. People are dying of different minority groups. There are biases in our legislation. There are biases in the way that we work. And they are systemic. They've been going on for a really long time and we're had by them. And all of us, you know, I have a lot of privilege in my life. I know that I am had by those things all the time, but it doesn't make me a bad person. So we talk a lot about fact versus truth. So truth is what we experience. So I'm cold, you might be hot. That's our truth. But the fact is it's 27 degrees. So I try to focus my anger and my calling out on the facts, not the truth. So all policemen aren't bad people, but we do have a system that is biased towards different races. And that has to change 100%. And then from my perspective, that's a no-brainer. Doesn't mean all police people are bad.
No. And also, I think, you know, to bring it around a little bit too, though, is sometimes we just talk about the systems that need to be changed and the system is still made of people.
100%. And we collude in that. And I think as allies as well, the opposite of this is, I think what we see is this idea that we always have to be good. Just like those people always are seen as bad, we have to be good. We have to be perfect. You can't be an ally if you have anything that's not right.
Yeah.
Sorry, you were saying?
Oh, I was just going to let everybody know we're going to jump to questions in a little bit. And I did want to talk a little bit about, you know, to do your best to ensure that you're not making mistakes. You know, what are some of the things that I know you do some of that work through inclusive design. And I, so maybe we can go there.
Yes. And I mean, I think also, I can't wait for your book to come out. You've got some great perspectives on how this can actually happen. And I think one of the things we have to unpack is what educate yourself means, right? Mm. So people have been talking about this a lot. Educate yourself. Do the hard work yourself. Well, how do we do that? Mm-hmm. And so I think whenever I feel like there's a mismatch between myself and other people, I ask, first of all, and then I go back and do whatever learning I can. So my question for myself recently was, well, why is it that you use this word black in such a different way? What was that about? And so I actually went back, thought about when I started using it and did some research and went, oh, okay, that's why, because this was a societal constraint at that time. That's what you bought into. That's not what's happening now. What's happening now? So really going back and looking at those things. The other thing that I try to do is have a diverse group of trusted advisors. Mm, yeah. And my trusted advisors are my friends, but I try to have people in that group that I can be hyper honest about with and ask anything to. And, you know, some of those people are my niece, for instance, is my trusted advisor when it comes to LGBTQ+ issues, because they are normalized in her world in a way that they're not normalized in my world. My son is my trusted advisor when it comes to anything where I might seem didactic, because, you know, for those people who have children in their lives, they are really great at pointing out all your failures. So he's great. He's a great trusted advisor and going, no, that doesn't sound right. Or, that sounds dumb, Mum. So whereas, and then other trusted advisors are people in the sector. So, you know, when I first joined the sector, I had two people, one who happens to be blind, and deaf. And their names are Bruce and Wayne. And I used to join them together and call them, you know, they were my superhero, the two of them, that really were so generous in the way that they have helped me to understand things I just don't get. So for me, talking helps. So I go to people. For other people, reading helps, go to books, whatever works. And when we get it wrong, just look at how and try to work from there.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I think I also have surround myself with a lot of colleagues that I can turn to for guidance, and they turn to me for guidance too. I think it's that's that mutual relationship that is so key, I think, to allyship and advocacy.
And you mentioned inclusive design. I mean, I think the thing we talk about in inclusive design is this idea that we learn from the edge. So people that design doesn't mm-hmm. work for. So anyone who finds something difficult and that the way they think about things from the edge is an insight for everyone. And because of that, it's a power shift. So it's not like we're doing things for the edge. The edge is teaching us how to do things better. And when that power dynamic changes, the conversation flourishes.
Excellent. We have a couple of questions I want to address. One is, what do you do when you make a mistake on social media where you're not sure how many people you hurt by it? This person says, I worry about hurting people more if I post an apology about it or not reaching all the people who are hurt.
Look, it's a really hard one. I feel like I'm not the guru on this, but I think my view is just don't post anything on social media that you wouldn't say to someone to their face. Mm. And in fact, I'm very careful about what I post on social media, because I think the way social media is used is really terrible. It sits in the wrong spaces in our lives. Often we have that phone next to us and we're sending out messages on the fly at times when we're often quite vulnerable. So, and there is no intent, you know. I remember talking to people in our office about email back in the day and saying email is a fault. You can't just put something on email and expect people to read it like a conversation. So first of all, what I would say is just think about social media as if someone has a microphone in front of your face and you're in the news. That's the first piece. And then look at when you have access to it. So I've closed my social media. I don't have social media on my system after work hours because that reminds me I can't post things in the middle of the night when I'm upset, when it's my personal space. That's the first thing. Second thing is if I publish something and I am concerned about it, I apologize and then close it down. Because I can't control other people's upset. And that upset is not often useful. If I can learn from it, that's great. But I only need to hear it once to learn from it. I don't need to hear it 15 or 20 times to learn from it. And I've been thinking about this a lot because if we can learn to do this, then we can teach our young people to do this. But at the moment, as young people teach us how to use social media, we're learning from people who are really black and white.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I would handle it a little bit differently. And I think that is the beauty of this, right?
Right.
You know, Alexi McCammon, yeah. I think that's how you say her last name, the Teen Vogue editor that just was forced to resign, basically, because of things she said, racist things she said 10 years ago when she was 17. Mm. And I think, you know, people held her to task on that and also on... And they also watched, you know, how she apologized, if she apologized, how what that apology looked like. And so I do think that, you know, when you're a public figure like that, you do have a responsibility to acknowledge.
Yes, you're right.
Yeah.
100%. 100%. So sorry, I didn't mean not acknowledge it, but to over-acknowledge it starts to become, it sounds like justification, right?
Yeah. So. Oh, right, right. Yes, absolutely. So acknowledge it.
Yes. So saying, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. Absolutely. But then I'd close it down. So I'd talk my truth. So this is what I said. This is what I meant. This is what I've learned from it. But then not keep discuss, like not keep in that social space because then it sounds like justification.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's this other really interesting thing that we've been talking about, which is the right to be forgotten and forgiven.
Mm-hmm.
So back in the day, before technology, we believed that people learned from their mistakes and that as we grew up, we learned that young people made mistakes, they learned from that, and we kept going and growing. But if we can't be forgiven for our mistakes and the consequences are grave 10, 15, 30 years later, that's really difficult. Especially because the world is changing. So what was okay behavior or was not okay behavior but wasn't seen as not okay behavior 20 years ago now becomes we're judging it by the standards we've learned today. And that's very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. Another question. I live online group settings, Zoom meetings. How can the leaders of those meetings quietly reigning, dominating attendees who do derail or monopolize the meeting? As a way of, you know, kind of interrupting a microaggression as that might be.
Okay, so there's a lot of ways we can do this. One of the questions we often ask is how don't we do it?
Mm.
So to the person speaking, I think, or asking the question, think about what assists the microaggression. Because sometimes cultures are different and whatever's assisting that microaggression, actually look at how we could do the opposite of it.
Hmm.
So sometimes we find that the person with their camera on is the person who dominates the conversation and the people with their microphones, with their cameras off, don't get to speak. So recently in a presentation, we actually said, well, you know, what we're seeing is the people without their microphones on aren't speaking up. It might be because you're uncomfortable, but keep your microphone off if you'd like to say something, if you're happy to say something. So actually just swap out the dynamic.
Hmm.
And then everybody whose microphone was off was then saying that they were comfortable being asked. And it changed the dynamic without that person kind of feeling like they were being victimized. Went, you know, it's awesome you've been answering stuff. How do we get other people to?
So actually just swapping it around. Also looking at the facilitator. So we know there are three people who normally have power in a room, right? The person with the pen, in that this instance, it's myself and Melinda. The person with the loudest voice. So we privilege people who speak. For someone like me, that's really interesting because that's been my power. I find it easier to speak, but I know that that comes with privilege as well. And the last one is the person who gets paid the most and has, you know, and so it's how do we keep those voices? And the other exercise that's really good, if you're looking for exercises around this, is asking people for the opposite viewpoint. So that's one viewpoint. What's the opposite viewpoint? Or what's a different viewpoint to that?
Yeah, and I would just add one more, which is at the beginning of the meeting to ask everyone to recognize airtime and how much airtime you're taking and to make sure that that is equitable across the team, whoever is on the call. Okay, we are out of time. Thank you, Manisha. Appreciate you.
You too. It's always a pleasure. I love being in your space. So thank you so much for letting me in.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And for everybody who is listening, appreciate you all and appreciating you do the work of change, asking the hard questions of yourselves and each other. And what step will you take forward as an ally now, knowing this and having gone through this conversation, find that courage uniquely differently. So thank you, everyone. And thank you, Manisha, again.
Thank you so much.
Next week, we have Designing for Intersectional Inclusion with Frida MacLear, who's a senior research associate for K4 Center. And there's a photo of her. She's a woman of color smiling at the camera. Bye. See you next week. For more learning resources about this episode's topic, visit changecatalyst.co/allyshipseries. Allyship is a journey. It's a journey of self-exploration, learning, unlearning, healing, and taking consistent action. And the more we take action, the more we grow as leaders and transform our communities. So what action will you take today? Share your actions and learning with us by emailing podcast@changecatalyst.co or on social media using #AllyshipPodcast. We'd love to hear from you. And thank you for listening. Please subscribe to the podcast and the YouTube channel and share this. Let's keep building allies around the world. Leading with Empathy and Allyship is an original show by Change Catalyst, where we build inclusive innovation through training, consulting, and events. It's produced by Juliet Roy and Be Your Change Media, with the team at Change Catalyst, Renzo Santos, Araya April, Sally Moywewa, and Emily Moss. Thank you for listening to our show and taking action as an ally. See you next week.